This is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhal.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, Sunday, November
19th, 2017.
Happy birthday, Granger Abuhal.
That's right. We're going in today to celebrate Granger's birthday. We're going into the city.
To celebrate with him and Nico, his girlfriend.
And to see
Brigadoon.
Brigadoon.
Special production by City Center.
Right.
The part of the Encores series where they revive.
Right. So they musicals. Revive. Yeah, their deal is they do weekend performances. And this is a special one, and it's only five performances. And Tamsin spotted this in advance.
Well, I noticed that Kelly O'Hara is in it.
Right. So, you know, it's a big deal.
So I thought maybe it will be good.
But you got to buy your tickets months in advance, and you're taking a risk. You never know. And then you take a deep breath and you look at the review the Friday before, as we did, to see is it any good or not. And what did they say, Tamsin?
Here's what Jesse Green said in the New York Times. Top drawer Golden Age musicals like Carousel and My Fair Lady, both coming to Broadway next spring, are still eminently playable. Those in the third drawer and below eminently aren't. After their one shot at resuscitation in City Center's Encore series, they often hastily return to the dusty Weehawken warehouse, where they unfortunately were rediscovered. Irma LaDuce, I mean you.
Right, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. And then what do they say?
Then he goes on to say, but what about the second drawer? And he says Brigadoon is basically fantastic.
Right. Glorious is the word he uses. Uh-huh. So we are gratified to see a great review for Brigadoon. And he goes on and he says this is a fabulous production of Brigadoon. And we'll give you a report next week. But it avoids all the pitfalls associated with Brigadoon, which can really get bogged down in a mediocre plot. And it's by Lerner and Lowe, and the book is by Alan J. Lerner, you know, has a tendency to get lost in these things, and they manage to navigate this in a successful way. And so we are, number one, very excited to see Brigadoon today.
But let me step back for a moment.
Very up in arms about this Jesse Green. And go ahead. Go ahead, Dan, well, to explain.
Daniel doesn't have complete confidence in this review.
Right.
And I have to say, I do take offense at the Irma LaDuce remark.
That's right.
Because Irma LaDuce happens to be a family favorite musical. Of the Grabuhoffs.
Of the Grabuhoffs.
We can all sing just about the whole score. There is no cure for l'amour on the bridge of Calancourt, etc. and so forth. And we can all dance to the Penguin March or whatever it is. I mean, it's a little odd because it's a musical about a lawyer and a prostitute.
Well, that's odd.
It's odd that that's our family theme. But
not alone. You know, here's our problem with Jesse Green here. I mean,
but we should just say that for years we were hoping Encores would do a production of Irma LaDuce. They did it. It was a terrible production.
It was terrible.
It was miscast.
It was misconceived.
It was awful. And
politically correct. Besides, it was a disaster.
They correctified it, and so now everybody hates Irma LaDuce.
No, not everybody. But this Jesse Green has obviously never seen a decent production of Irma LaDuce. He saw the Encores production a year or two ago. It was terrible, and he thinks it's terrible. Or worse, possibly, he saw the movie Irma LaDuce, which was so bad and so brutal, they did not use any of the show music in the movie Irma LaDuce, if you can believe it. So it's incredible.
But enough about Irma.
No, well, I'm just saying he doesn't know, but he also doesn't know Brigadoon. Because what he says, he's amazed at how they managed to navigate the difficulties in Brigadoon. I got news for this guy. We saw a production of Brigadoon 25 years ago. It might have been City Opera, but we remember who was in it. It was fantastic. Brigadoon is great. And again, how could he have experienced Brigadoon? He probably saw the movie Brigadoon, which was a disaster. I mean, how he could be wringing his hands about Alan J. Lerner having difficulties bringing home a musical. Alan J. Lerner wrote My Fair Lady, all right, with Frederick Lowe. So we have our doubts about Jesse Green.
He has a clue.
He has a clue. Alan J. Lerner does, at least. But in any event, we will give you a report on Brigadoon next week. We're confident that it's going to be a great production. We're looking forward to a great afternoon. But one of the biggest stories of this week have been strangely right in Tamsin's wheelhouse in Museum Update. And I will just say, even I, who was not particularly attentive to stories of this sort, keep running.
Well, economics were involved.
Economics were involved, so that has brought me to it. And then the two stories, of course, that I keep reading about are number one, the sale of the Leonardo painting, and number two, the exhibit of the Michelangelo sketches, I believe, at the Metropolitan Museum. I keep running into articles about that, but I will now hand the microphone to Miss Granger, who will give us the museum update and comment on those and other
stories.
Well,
I've lost count. Of course, this Salvador Mundi sold to some private party for, well, the, I guess the...
I saw $450, right?
Well, $450 including all the fees.
Right. Okay. And Salvador Mundi, just to be clear, is the name of the painting.
Name of the painting.
Right.
And
$450 million. Right.
It's a rediscovered Leonardo. We've discussed it before. Maybe it's a Leonardo.
Maybe it's not.
Maybe it's not.
Let's assume it is.
Even if it is, even if there are touches of Leonardo, is it any good, et cetera, right, and so forth. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me in the last few days and said, is it really worth it?
Yeah.
You know, even my mother on the phone this morning said, you know, how can a painting be worth that much? And she said, what makes it worth all that? And she starts going into all her theories.
Right.
And I said, it's worth whatever anyone will pay for.
Now you sound like an investment banker. That's the definition. When you ask an investment banker, what is a company worth? They say it's whatever people will pay for it.
So don't you think that's true?
Obviously it's true. Economically it's true.
So
I wouldn't have bid any more than $375 million. I think we stopped at that point.
So, and to be honest, I know nothing about the sort of fungibility of all these artworks.
No, but the critics that you see, they're saying two things. Number one, there's some question about the provenance of the painting. And even putting those aside, people saying, well, you know, something that's not a very good painting. It could be Leonardo. It could not. Let's assume it is. You know, he doesn't always have his best day. Not a great painting. And yet, there are no Leonardos in private hands, and frankly, this may not be in private hands. I think you were telling me this actually may be owned by a museum.
Well, it may be heading for a museum.
Yeah.
I mean, that. So, but anyway.
Okay. What are the other big art stories?
Well, no, I just also wanted to say people did comment about why was the Leonardo, this old master painting, in an auction?
Right.
It was mostly, you know, newer paintings, 20th century paintings, etc. Right. And one article I read said, well, because most of the painting was actually done in the 20th century.
Oh, some wag said that.
Yes,
I see.
Meaning that it was
that's a little art joke.
You know, most of what's there is really 20th century paint. So, so what else is going on? Well, museum update, I didn't say anything about Michelangelo.
Oh, sure.
You're right. People are super excited about the Michelangelo exhibition at the Metropolitan. And it has drawings, but it also has a to-scale recreation of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, which people say is very good.
Yeah.
And it warmed the cockles of my heart that one of my students actually went to the exhibition.
You're kidding me.
And
that never happened.
Yeah, and this was one of those students who said, do we have to go to the Met?
It's an impeccable impression.
I really
of a
just
student.
Wanted
yes.
to go to MoMA.
Oh, that's good.
And, you know, I really like Jackson Pollock.
I hope they're not listening.
You know?
Yeah, go ahead.
And this person went to the Met, saw the Michelangelo, and, you know, went crazy.
Here's
about
the question. The question is it the kind of exhibit that's of such stature that your husband should attend it?
I think it's a fun exhibition because a variety of things going on that he did.
Yeah.
Drawings, a painting he did that was a copy of a popular engraving, The Torture of St. Anthony. He did it, I think, when he was like 12 or 13 years old.
Yeah.
So it's a fun range of what
right.
he did.
I'll consider it.
And I think you could
it's not like I'm not
feel
Manhattan
free to
day.
Enjoy it without saying, oh, this is art.
Well, there we go now.
This is famous
this
art.
Is, you're doing your student now or you're doing me?
I must like it if I am a cultured person.
Okay.
You know,
move on.
I think
move
it can
on.
Be, you know,
move on. What's the next?
Actually engaging. Also, we're happy for the Met financially.
Right.
Because they got a gift of $80 million.
That helps out.
Which will solve some problems.
Right.
You know, nothing a little money can't cure. And it was actually from Florence and Herbert Irving, co-founders of the food company, Sisco. You see the giant Sisco trucks going by?
Yeah.
And, you know, we when I had my food business, I paid money to Sisco. So, you know.
There are two major nationwide distributors in the country. One of them is Sisco. They're the number one.
I mean, they gave $600 million to Columbia.
It's a lot of paper cups.
So they only gave 80 to the Met.
We've got a lot of Cisco stock. And
the Met is theoretically doing better. Their deficit was smaller than they imagined. They thought it would be $15 million. It's only 10. And they expect to be out of that trouble.
They could always sell Leonardo if they have to and can put him back on solid ground.
I don't think they would.
No.
So what else is going on in the museum world? There is, not exactly a museum, but there's an exhibition that some people may want to see, and that is about Downton Abbey.
Oh, God, I saw that. Yeah.
And it's actually...
It's downtown Manhattan, right?
No, it's not downtown. It's Columbus Circle.
Oh, is it Columbus Circle?
Yeah.
No kidding. Well, that's...
housed in a Victorian-era building.
That makes no sense. Because Columbus Circle, you know what that looks like. In the middle of that, they have this little faux
museum.
In
a Victorian-era building.
I'll have to see it. I can't envision that in Columbus Circle.
That would be, it's 218 West 57th. So they've recreated rooms from the series.
Right, and they have furnishings from the series.
They have furnishings, you know, they have all kinds of details. You walk into Mary's bedroom, you walk in to, what's her name, Mrs. Patmore's kitchen.
Right.
Okay. And they also have all, you know, a lot of the dresses.
Right. That's supposedly the big draw.
The outfits.
Right.
So that's a big excitement.
And they have some, they spice it up because they have some intonations of audible sounds from the cast members.
Mm-hmm.
So like the guy was the head butler saying, thank you for coming. We'll hope to see you again or something like that.
Yeah. And so the article says, well, what does that mean? You know, is there really, you know,
is there going to be a
movie?
Yeah.
Is there going to be a sequel?
You got to be a super Downton Abbey fan, but it's there. It costs $30 or something.
It does cost $30.
Yeah.
Oh, you're up on that.
It's Columbus Circle, dear.
The other exhibition that I want to bring attention to is not causing quite all the kerfuffle that Michelangelo and Downton Abbey maybe is a nice little exhibition at the Bard Graduate Center, which is on West 86th Street.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Bard Graduate Center often has fun exhibitions. Went to a great hat, like History of Hats exhibition there. Went to a great History of American Christmas Cards exhibition there.
Now you're on a roll. What now, Tamsin?
They're having an exhibition on the work of John Lockwood Kipling. Designer, architectural sculptor, educator. Born in 1837, died in 1911.
Yeah.
He was Rudyard Kipling's daddy. And so he, you know, he was an architectural sculptor for what became the V&A. And then he was actually an educator and museum curator in India for many years.
Right.
Hence Rudyard's love of
India. And writing about India. Right.
So that looks... So he turns out he's a kind of an unsung hero of the 19th century... revival of arts and crafts.
Do people know who Rudyard Kipling is anymore?
Possibly not.
Well,
but
I don't know.
There is a chance
great
that
writer,
some of our listeners,
Gunga Din,
he's
a great English writer.
But I'm conflicted about him
because.
Because the whole thing where
the PBS series and his son.
Yes, he facilitated his son going to war.
He encouraged his son, who was terribly nearsighted, to go to war. And
almost immediately. Dies like on his 18th birthday.
And to make it even worse, he was played by the kid who played Harry Potter, which Daniel Radcliffe.
What's wrong with him?
Nothing, but it just made that much more vulnerable and touching.
That he's the one who
died. It's hard to see Harry Potter shot down with his glasses broken like that.
So anyway, and he wrote, you know, If for Boys, that whole...
Yeah. He had this all big machismo, bravado thing. That's clear in his writing, and he clearly imposed that on his son, who was kind of physically unimposing. Didn't work out very well.
Battle. Well, that was a horrific war. But anyway, so this looks interesting to me.
Uh-huh.
And as I'm scrolling through the various events that are associated with it, I notice there's an event that covers his relationship with another Lockwood.
Yeah.
Lockwood DeForest,
right,
who was an American artist and designer who actually had a business with Louis Comfort Tiffany,
right,
also loved India.
Yeah.
Okay. And he and Lockwood Kipling meet in India when DeForest is on his honeymoon. He's a not quite 20 years younger, maybe like 13 or 14 years younger than Kipling. So I scrolled down. They had a whole day of events about their interaction.
Sure.
And guess what? The keynote speaker was one of my favorite experts on it, Roberta Mayer, Dr. Roberta Mayer.
Your buddy, Roberta.
Yes, from Bucks County Community College.
The two Lockwoods,
And so, so that's all very interesting, exciting. Bard Graduate Center.
Well,
fun place to see. Interesting little exhibitions, kind of off the main road.
Okay. You're missing the symbol.
You won't stand in line.
The listeners are missing the symbol for off the main road.
With the people,
requires both
the big crowd trying to see Michelangelo. Although the Michelangelo is worth seeing.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Look,
sometimes
you worry
about blockbusters.
Not to be outdone. In the world of sports, there are a lot of cultural upheavals. The principal one is this. Mike Francesa is leaving WFAN.
I thought he already left.
You were wrong. Mike Francesa is still there. They're having events now to commemorate the fact that he'll be moving on. He's not leaving until the middle of December. He's been there for 25 or 30 years. To give you a sense of the gravitas in his position, his nickname and his sports radio post is the Pope. He is the Pope. He is the final word. He is the most serious man,
sports.
The authoritarian, the ultimate authority, Mike Francesa. And he has, as you would expect, a following. He's in drive time, which is the prime time for radio listening, and it's in the afternoons. And he has a bunch of folks who call on a regular basis, and many who can't get through, to advance their thoughts about sports and have Mike shoot them down and put them on the right path. First time, long time, meaning first time caller, long time listener. And he's a big deal in New York. But here's what's interesting about this. He's leaving. You say, fine, people leave. But he's being replaced.
He says that, but he's really quite bereft.
Well, I'll tell you why I'm bereft. I'll come back to that. My bereftness is important. He is going to be replaced, according to WFN, by these three folks, three younger people. Takes three to fill the spot. And without going into them or naming names, it's kind of awful. I mean, they're kind of nothing sportscasters. We all listen to them to some degree. They're pretty uninteresting. They don't bring anything to it. Maybe they're going to giggle their way through it. But mostly they're younger. That's what they're bringing to the table. And
younger.
Yes, and it's such a stark contrast that Mike's longtime partner called Mad Dog, hence the phrase Mike and the Mad Dog, has gone on record saying it's an insult to Mike Francesa that is being replaced by these nobodies.
Well, it's funny that he says that because he's really just, it's kind of a, not a left-handed compliment, but it's a way to stick it to Mike, really.
You think so?
Yes. I think he's saying that to be mean, not to be nice.
No, I don't think so.
Here's
what I think is really going on. Francesa, at his credit, says this. He says, look, I think they're just going in a different direction. And that's really what's happening here.
It's a different demographic.
Yeah. In other words, it was Francesa's idea to leave. But the station isn't too unhappy to see him going because they're looking to change their listenership. And they're going with a group that they hope attracts younger, different listeners who are interested in different aspects of sports, who are interested in fantasy sports and things like that, the kind of stuff that Francesa won't
but
even
do they listen to
talk
the radio?
About. Well, I don't know. And I hope they...
And would they listen to the radio?
Listen, I hope they fail.
But they don't drive cars.
And I expect them to fail. They don't...
They
can't spell cars. I mean, look, whatever happens, happens. But here's the point. Number one, for those of us who are near that age, I mean, it's the handwriting...
Near the young age or near the old age?
Near Francesa's age.
Yes.
The point is, he is, in the view of his management, they're sorry to see him go, but not that sorry. And the fact that they're picking different kind of people who don't measure up to Mike or aren't of his type doesn't say much about Mike. It really shows where the business is going. And that's true in businesses across the entire country.
Kinds
of businesses.
Yeah.
And that's just reality. So, that's number one, first and foremost, what's going on. But the other thing that's more interesting to me, given where I'm sitting, as you mentioned to me, the station's firing its listenership.
Yes.
Okay.
That's an interesting way to put it.
That's what they're doing. They're saying, it's been nice having you,
but
we're looking for different sponsors and different listeners.
Yeah.
So you can find another station.
Yeah.
So you see these people calling and lamenting to Mike, who am I going to listen to? I can't listen to those guys. And he can't even defend it.
Yeah. I understand that point.
They're fired.
Absolutely.
So I'm fired. I'm fired. I know all these other people. You're going to see a lot of middle-aged men moping around New York with nothing to do between 4 and 7 in the afternoon.
Well, what they can do is download the podcast.
What, download our podcast?
Yes.
I thought you were going to send them to the Met. They can also look at the Michelangelo drawings. Those are the two things that are available to them. But podcasting, that might be the way to go. But you had another story about podcasting in a different
Jesse,
area.
You know, I was looking at the travel section of the Times, yeah. And they say podcasts are being used a lot in travel.
Really?
Both by places, you know, by travel sort of writers or, you know, commentators, mm-hmm. and but also by hotels, the actual places providing mm-hmm. podcasts to enhance the experience at the location or so yeah. on and so forth. And what I found especially interesting in the article was just a little bit of a discussion about podcasts, because mm-hmm. we're kind of interested in podcasts now. And they say podcasts really are, you know, coming more into their own. Right. More and more people know about them.
Well, they must be listening to us.
Yeah, and so that 40% of Americans over the age of 12 have listened to a podcast, okay? 24% have listened to one in the previous month,
mm-hmm.
okay? And 6 in 10 say they're familiar with the term podcasting, a 22% increase over 2 years ago.
Right.
So podcasting is really coming along. And right. so that's kind of fun. So really we encourage,
right.
of course, our listeners
yes.
To subscribe,
sure. right.
to spread the word, etc.
Right.
But it goes on to discuss one particular company and how they spent $4,000 to put together a podcasting studio.
Right.
It's actually a travel insurance company who is using travel podcasts to kind of promote their business.
Right.
And, $4,000 is not all that much, so it's not a huge investment. And they talk about it only costs about $200. Ellie, don't listen to this. $200
a month
to edit,
yeah.
and $20 for podcast hosting.
Right.
We don't even get $20 for podcast hosting, do we? But I think they mean the hosting on the internet.
Yeah. It'll be paying the host.
But it does note, and here's the one thing that really applies to us, there will always be a place for a few friends sitting around a kitchen table with a USB microphone and a laptop, as long as they talk about interesting stuff.
There you go.
So,
there we go. I was just wondering where we get the $4,000 for the studio, but yes.
No,
our place in the marketplace.
Here we are.
Back
at the kitchen table.
All right. So Uwe Reinhardt died this week. Uwe Reinhardt was a very popular professor at Princeton when we were at Princeton. He was in the economics department.
Did you take any classes with him?
I did not. He was in the Woodrow Wilson School, but I thought he was extremely well known. He became much more well known as time went on because his area was healthcare policy.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the hot area when we were in school, but it became a much hotter area. And he had a very interesting background. He had grown up in Germany. He was a post-war adolescent in Germany, and he left Germany when he was an adolescent because he's, you know, given his understanding and familiarity with the atrocities of the Nazi regime, he couldn't see serving in the military in Germany, and he actually went to Canada, and he had no money at all, and the story in the obituary talks about how he sort of lived on oatmeal, and he sold his guitar, and he managed to work overtime at all kinds of menial jobs to scrape enough money together to go to a state-run college in Canada,
mm.
where he sufficiently distinguished himself that he got a scholarship to do graduate work in Yale, and that became the beginning of his big career. He was a brilliant guy. But what's interesting in particular about him is, you know, it's about healthcare, and which is such a big issue every year, this year perhaps more than any other year, but it just keeps becoming bigger and bigger. And what he was saying from the get-go was that the market for U.S. healthcare is kind of crazy. And the reason is because the prices are kept behind, as he put it, a veil of secrecy. That market, he said, is one in which employers become the sloppiest purchasers, of healthcare anywhere in the world. And that administrative costs are unbelievable because our hospitals spend twice as much on administration as any hospital anywhere in the world because of the complexity of the maze of insurers, et cetera. And what he said then is true now, even more true now. He contrasted that with Germany, which even though he had his issues with Germany, he said German healthcare is inexpensive and equitable. Coverage is portable. You're never uninsured in Germany. No family goes broke over healthcare bills. And a lot of his principles were adopted in Obamacare, but not all of them. We're not talking about whether Obamacare works or not. It's hard to adopt things piecemeal, so who knows whether it works or it doesn't. But it is quite interesting that he consistently couldn't believe how bad the healthcare system was in the U.S. and how economic principles would be needed to guide it right. And obviously, that's a situation which never solved itself. Even through Obamacare, we're still in the throes of something. And one thinks about this when you see the release this week of the new blood pressure advice.
The guidelines.
Yeah, and to be specific, here's what they are. Systolic blood pressure is the first number that you hear in blood pressure readings. It was generally considered for some time at 140. It was relaxed as the critical point above which you need medication. It was relaxed to 150 for patients 60 and older in 2013, and now they've done some new study and they're changing the 150 not to 140 but to 130. And as a result, recommendations on that basis will mean an enormous number of people will be told by their doctors that they have to get blood pressure medication, particularly people over 60. And what the article in the Times says, and this is on their op-ed page by a fellow named Gilbert Welch, who is a doctor, is he says, look, I bet I'm not the only doctor whose blood pressure jumped upon hearing this news. And he explains what those statistics mean. He said, look, it's based on a study that says that that if we lower the threshold from 150 to 130, there'll be a 25% reduction in critical care events involving the heart. But he says, if you look closely at the study, there's not much going on there. What the study actually shows is that you had a situation where 8% of people were having these kind of events at the 150 level, and the prediction would be 6% if in fact it changed from 150 to 130. And that's the whole result. 8% versus 6%, or put another way, the way he puts it, 92% are okay versus 94% are okay. And on that basis, we're going to turn medication for high blood pressure upside down. And he says, and plus the study is not that reliable in several ways. One is that it only had people who were at risk to begin with. They're the only people who were involved in the study. They measured blood pressure in a way that you normally wouldn't measure it. One of the big things with blood pressure is you get artificial highs because people have white cloak disease. They see the doctor and have higher blood pressure. They took these people's blood pressure several times during the day, every day for a period, so they got the lowest possible reading. In many ways, it's not reliable. He just is very concerned about advising people to take medication that might not be useful for them. But his point is encapsulated this way. He says, focusing on the number 130 not only will involve millions of people, but also involve millions of new prescriptions and millions of dollars, and will further distract doctors and their patients from activities that aren't easily measured by numbers, yet are more important to health. Real food, regular movement, and finding meaning in life. These matter, whatever your blood pressure is.
Right.
Which I think is right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing that occurred to me is, who's encouraging this? Who's going to benefit from this?
Well, we know who's going to benefit. It's the pharmaceutical companies. Right. But it's not so much pointing fingers, but it just adds to the morass. It's just more thing that turns people on its head.
And on the heart attack front,
yes,
and the complicated world that it is, figuring out who will have heart attacks and who's healthy and who's not. This past week, the president of the American Heart Association, John Warner, age 52, had a heart attack the day after he gave a talk to his fellow...
That's what we call anecdotal evidence, but it's not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing. Well, he has... for him, it's a hereditary situation.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go.
It just points out to you what a complicated... situation it is.
Okay. Well, it is complicated. It is kind of a mess. Anyway, you had a couple of book reviews.
Yeah. So, I got burned a couple times last year with holiday books. I don't know what it is. people get excited about books at holiday time. Maybe they say too many nice things. So I was reluctant. The Wall Street Journal had a big holiday books section with all these reviews of things you might want to give, you might want to read.
Yeah, I found one book for myself.
So I held back. Well, the book you want sounds good. It's about jazz and pop.
That sounds
kind of fun, actually. And I found two fun ones that are intriguing. And one is Bird Mania by Bernd Brunner. And this was written in Germany, in German, and translated. It's translated from German. And it's a history of all these crazy ornithologists.
Yeah.
And, you know, more interesting ones. And they do point out that bird watching, bird collecting, bird fascination has changed a lot over the years. No longer do you have to actually shoot a bird, you know, and kill it to collect it, because now we have cameras, you know, and all sorts of facilities like that to use. But back in the day, it was, you know, a lethal sort of sport.
Right.
And so he discusses some interesting ones, especially Frank Chapman, who had kind of a complicated story. He prided himself on collecting especially this this wild Carolina parakeet.
Yeah.
And he prided himself on having shot 15 of them.
Yeah.
Why he needed 15, who knows. But not too long after that, 30 years later after that, the species was entirely extinct. And so then he felt bad. And he is, you know, this is the late 19th, early 20th century. He actually, at a certain point, he's also famous for walking down the streets of Manhattan and noticing and noting all the feathers from birds in ladies' hats.
Oh, really?
Because, of course, ladies were wearing hats, and how that was a threat to these birds, etc. Right. So anyway, it's it sounds like a fun book. Lots of stories about you know, ornithologists from all over, and including some women as well. So Bird Mania is an exhilarating, if somewhat scattershot, field guide to people caught in the everlasting thrall of birds. And the other book, you know, I'm always sucked in by the food books.
Yeah,
you know, sad to say. And this one is The Gourmand's Way by Justin Spring. And it's about various Americans who were obsessed with French cooking and wrote about it. Well, French food, French drinking as well.
Right.
And a gourmand is like a gourmet, but more so.
Right.
Gourmands are, you know, the overindulgence. It's about A.J. Liebling, Emma K. Fisher, Richard Olney, Alexis Lachine, Alice B. Toklas, Julia Child. Alice B. Toklas, you know, writes that cookbook because when Gertrude Stein dies, she is not even, you know, I have to research this, but apparently she's not able to inherit the paintings, the painting collection, the amazing collection.
So she's writing a cookbook to make money.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
She writes a cookbook to make money, and it has the famous recipe for basically hash brownies in it.
Oh, yeah, I think there's something about drugs. Peter Sellers book. I love you, Alice B. Toklas.
Yes.
Isn't that what that's about?
Yeah. Yeah, and not to mention...
All right, now you're getting into movies, now I'm in.
Okay, but anyway, sounds like a fun, interesting read.
Okay.
You never really know till you get there.
Right.
But the reviewer, Moira Hodgson, who I sometimes trust, says the author has packed an enormous amount of material into this book, which is erudite, gossipy, entertaining, and eminently readable.
All right. Well, speaking of movies, we get there a funny way in our last substantive story. And there, the Times included.
Well, we got an extra section to the Times.
It's called
The New York Times
for kids.
It says,
on the editor's note, this section should not be read by grown-ups. But
you know why.
Why?
Because it's stupid.
Well, take it easy. There's only one section I looked at. It has a section which it says 12 movies to see before you turn 13. In other words, 12 movies to see when you're 12, okay? And I, you know, I paid my money. I'm opening up the section. What are they telling 12-year-old kids that they have to see before they turn 13? And I'm not going to list every movie. I'll just list a few of them.
No, go ahead, list everyone.
No.
But don't comment on
everyone. No, I don't have to list
everyone. You want to give the full list everyone.
Okay. They list The Wiz, which I can get. They list the Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers is a movie, Jim Belushi, about these guys making believe they blew the blues. It's an R-rated movie, okay? It's about, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but really just the sex and the drugs. And look, I'm not hung up on the R-rating system, even though it means you have to be accompanied by an adult unless you're 17. But do I think a 12-year-old would enjoy it, would get anything out of it, would I want him to see it? No. Next movie is Spaceballs. Mel Brooks comedy. No 12-year-old's going to get it, but fine. The next movie is Die Hard. Die Hard is rated R. Why? Because of the violence. Again, am I overly concerned about R ratings? Not overly concerned. Is Die Hard a real good movie? No. So why is it important, or why would you even suggest a 12-year-old see it? Don't know. Do the Right Thing. Okay, Spike Lee joint, right? So it's a very interesting movie, Do the Right Thing. Do I know a 12-year-old?
I'm not sure I was old enough to see it when I saw it.
Do I know a 12-year-old in America who might get anything out of Do the Right Thing or should see it or whatever? Again, rated R. Really? Next, Paris is Burning. Rated R. We can't go into all these at great length. The League of Their Own, I get it. They got, that's one out of 12.
See that?
That and The Wiz. Princess Mononoke, which I know is animated, which is very well praised. I don't know if it's really a kid's movie, but I don't know too much about it. Catch Me If You Can. Catch Me If You Can, which is PG-13, was kind of an interesting movie. Christopher Walken, Leonardo DiCaprio, about a con artist. They say it's about a teenage con artist. It is for about 90 seconds. It's really not about a teenage con artist. It's about two adult con artists. One's the father, one is the person that the son becomes. And it's frankly most interesting in talking about the way people are willing to be swindled. 12-year-olds aren't going to get that. I don't see how. Spellbound, movie about spelling bees, that's right on. Enchanted, go with it. Be Kind, Rewind, just not much of a movie, PG-13. But I mean, how they came up with this list, I don't know. I think I do know, but they signed it, some actor come up with a list, but it's not, I wouldn't be surprised if they got some letters about
this. Well,
you know
what you should do?
What?
You should come up with a list.
Not this week.
So maybe in a future podcast.
Movies
you
to see before
with, yeah, and not just
I think I would do movies to see before you're 63.
No, I think you should do it.
All right.
I think you can't really criticize somebody for not being able to do it.
Very easy.
But I will say my point of view about this is, and I absolutely agree. And it's not about bad words or sex or anything like that. That I'm squeamish about people seeing on the screen. But there's more of a sense. I remember when I was in college.
Yeah.
A friend of my parents, I was talking to a friend of my parents, and she mentioned that we were talking about whatever movie was playing in Princeton at the time.
Yeah.
And it was some like Ingmar Bergman film, something like that. And I said, oh, well, there's that. And she said, oh, well, that's not for children.
Right.
Meaning me,
right.
A college
right.
kid. And I was highly insulted.
Right.
On the other hand, later, I realized she was right.
Yeah.
It's not that I wasn't old enough to see, adults interacting.
It takes a lot of patience.
It was, I wouldn't get it.
Yeah.
I hadn't been there.
Well,
these characters were not going to resonate with me. The issues were not going to resonate with me.
But that's
what it's about.
You know what but you know what also the issue is with this article that I'm pointing at now? It really confirms what a lot of people talk about, Planet New York Times. Planet New York Times is written for people who live in large brownstones, who kids have been told to grow up too fast, who are totally unsupervised, or just out of touch with what it is to be a child. And on Planet New York Times, this is what people watch when they're 12 years old. Planet New York Times not being either United States or New York. So
yeah.
They're going to be made fun of for this, and they should be. So we'll close.
We're looking forward to Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we are looking forward to Thanksgiving.
As Sadie likes to say, it's our Super Bowl.
That's Sadie and you in particular.
We have a great bunch of the the core group is a great bunch of cooks and...
the core group, otherwise being known as the family.
Cooks and eaters and drinkers.
That's right.
Yeah.
Unless you meant to exclude
people
me.
People rotate in and out, but the core...
I'm on the edge of the core group.
And looking forward to seeing everybody. They're a little more scattered now, so that's going to be fun.
Right.
And
Thanksgiving's a great holiday.
And we are thankful.
Right. And we are thankful. But you know, sometimes you look for stories. I certainly was looking for stories this week.
We've been reading a lot of sort of... cliched, lame,
right.
You know, what are you thankful for?
What are you thankful for?
Thanksgiving
They come
articles.
Across, it's a little, you know, sometimes just counting, sometimes it's like keeping score, sometimes it's like a Facebook page.
But you noticed a wonderful, poignant...
Yes, which wasn't offered in connection with Thanksgiving, which was offered in the science section by the Times for reasons which I'll never understand. And it's called... Words that change everything. And it resonated with me because, to me, the stories that resonate on Thanksgiving are stories about people who it's not obvious they have anything to be thankful for, that they're facing a difficult road, and it's their resilience which allows them to look ahead and see the light at the end of the tunnel and see things to possibly be thankful for in the future. Those are stories which somehow make an impression, and this is one such story. It's written by a woman who's a doctor. Her name is Danielle Press. And it begins in a cute way. It says... as the old Yiddish proverb goes, man plans and God laughs, and man did I plan. And she tells a story about how she went to medical school, obviously requiring a great commitment, met a young man there, and they fell in love, and they got married, and she had a residency, and everything seemed to be on the right track as she had planned it to be. And there were two events in her life that just each... focused on a couple of words and that changed her life. The first is that she found herself growing apart from this man. And at a certain point, she had to confront him and she said, what is it? Are you not interested in me? Do you not love me? Do you have another lover? Are you gay? And he said to her, I think I might be. And
So they split up.
So they split up and she took a match, that's what it's called in a residency, in a different locale, and ended up moving to a completely different place and starting her.
Sort and they had been best friends.
Best friends. They're very
before
close.
Before they right. sort of fell in love.
But that was a deal breaker
so
for obvious
it was
reasons.
It was a huge right. change.
So now she's in a different locale and meeting new people and getting her education back on track. And then she experiences some kind of problems with her lungs. She's coughing. She's having trouble breathing. She's a doctor, but she can't tell what it is. First, they say it's a blockage, and as these things go, there's a lot of tests and a lot of possible diagnosis. And finally, they sit her down after the most complete set of testing, and they say to her, lung cancer. And she, of course, is devastated by that. But what the article is about is that notwithstanding those events, she has to take a step back. She relies on her family to some degree. She's in the middle of treatment. She's working it through. And interestingly, and perhaps most poignantly, she calls on her former husband for
who
support.
Who happens to be back there in the same area at
right.
this point.
And it
and
is.
And he once again acts as her best friend.
Right. And she comes back. And this is the event that brings her back to him. And that's what she's reflecting on in this story as she looks forward and the situation is summed up by these paragraphs at the end, which Tamsin will speak to.
I have now been living with cancer for a year, says Danielle. Treatment has at times left me feeling sicker than I ever could have imagined. I have felt deeply angry, profoundly sad, and all round terrified. But for the first time, I am also learning to enjoy the here and now instead of focusing on the later. I might never see the finish line of fellowship graduation, but I am still a doctor. I am lucky enough to be learning every day and can still make my own patients' lives better. My years of education and training have allowed me to build a supportive community of friends and colleagues throughout the country. I have a family who has stayed by me through all of it. And for better or worse, I have a gay ex-husband who is here for me always.
So, we all have something to be thankful for.
We
Happy
do
Thanksgiving.
And we'll be back again next week with Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
Thanks.